Good morning, everyone. Good morning, lovely people. Today I have a special woman in business, Geraldine Baun. She is a business mentor and a registered celebrant. Celebrant. Now, I'm telling you, there are two different businesses, two different areas. So why those two areas, Geraldine?
Well, I started off, good morning, Bogdan. Good morning, everybody. I started off in the 1980s with a management consultancy. That was my original business, which was called the Domino Consultancy. And at the time, I was helping companies to prepare open self-instructional materials, open learning materials. And I was looking at their processes to smarten their processes and what I would call some typical management consultancy tasks. But as I was out and about, of course, all the people I was dealing with were men. I don't have a problem with that, but I was working in large organizations with a large number of women, and there were no women anywhere near the top. So then privately I'd worked in what was called then a refuge for battered women, terrible name, but that's how they were referred to. And so I'd had a personal interest in empowering women anyway. And then I started looking at what was going on in organizations that women just weren't progressing when I knew how good they were. So then I started that side of the business in my consultancy, which was started off with women's workshops, then progressed to equality issues, because pretty soon organizations were saying, well, do you do race as well? And do you do disability as well? So then it moved from just women to equality. And at the time, there was legislation in the UK about discrimination, but nobody understood it. And managers had no idea how they were falling foul of the discrimination laws. And so companies were being fined horrendous amounts. So they realized they would have to do something. So they wanted to put all their managers through equalities training. So we picked up a lot of work with people just doing what I call straight equalities training. Then, of course, that widened out to not just the bits, to diversity in general. So I decided this was a niche market. So I decided I wanted to be one of the leaders in the UK. In 5 years. In fact, I did that in 3 years. So in three years, I was the top five consultancies in the UK offering, it was called equal opportunities training. Okay. Then it kind of moved to diversity training because I realized it was to do with every kind of difference, like which school you went to, what your accent was, or what your hair color was. I mean, everything. It wasn't just things that weren't covered by law, but still caused people to not get on with other people. So then we started training managers about their responsibility in appreciating difference. And that appreciating difference workshop I did for the next 25 years, because it was the one everybody wanted. So I think it was in 2007 that I worked for PepsiCo International. And I think I visited 26 countries training their managers using this particular workshop about appreciating difference and personal responsibility. I was one of three consultancies on the project, and we won an award for that, for the quality of the training. So that was good.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah, that was very good. So at the same time as that, I mean, it was... So that contract was 2007. But meanwhile, I'd moved to Ireland in 2002. I was based in the UK. And then I was with a partner at the time, and we found a property in Ireland for a holiday home. So we bought that. And then 2 years later, we actually relocated here. Now, in the meantime, I had my business was Domino Consultancy, but I realized if I wanted to grow, I had to not be the only focal point, because if that was the case, clients always wanted me, and they thought everybody else was kind of second best. So then I thought, okay, so, and I had a staff of about 15 by this time. So I thought, okay, I need to switch this. So I set up another company called Domino Perspectives, which is the one I have now. where the strap line was change your perspective, change everything. So that was the strap line for that. The strap line for Domino Consultancy was from equality to diversity to unity. So that was the strap line for that one. So I wanted to see, could I survive with my personal clients without Domino Consultancy? And could Domino Consultancy survive without me?
Without,
So that was the strategy, you know. Anyway, now, I mean, eventually, my partner at the time, he took over the business, but basically, he ran it into the ground. So that business doesn't exist anymore, Domino Consultancy. But Domino Perspectives does exist. So
That's.
all my consultancy work, workshops work, etc., and now business mentoring, I do as part of Domino Perspectives. You know, the only consultancy work that I actually do is for years now, I've done one workshop in Zurich every year on authenticity, power, and leadership for a group of senior women in different organizations who come together. So they bring me back every year to run that workshop. I'm sure ultimately that's got a shelf life, but I keep saying, look, if you think this is at the end of the line, it's like, no, your feedback is the best feedback we have on our workshop. So I guess, you know, as in all training, you're only as good as your last workshop. So, you know, if there comes a point when I don't deliver on the workshop, of course, then they'll phase me out, but that's not happened yet, you know. And meanwhile, I thought, well, I've done all of this. I'd written three books for women managers. I'd written one book with a colleague about diversity. So I thought, you know, there'll be. Now I just lost my thread then, what I was saying then ultimately about that. Okay, I can't remember what that was. So I then thought, well, I need to use my expertise because I'm only doing one workshop, what I call a consultancy workshop once a year. But then I've got all this knowledge. I've been in business for nearly 40 years. So there have to be things that I've learned, you know, that I can maybe help other small businesses. I obviously was a very small business. So that's when I started doing business mentoring. And I had two women who I mentored, and it really just got, it's only for a few months, it gets them over a hump. If they get to a stalemate in the business, or they're just wanting to expand and now they're not sure what to do and what their role should be. And so I mentor them over a period until they've kind of, you know, are into the next phase, you know. So I still do the business mentoring. So that's now what, that's why my LinkedIn profile actually is headed business mentor, you know. But meanwhile, I had been ordained as an interfaith minister in 1998. So I've been a minister since 1998. So how long's that? 20 whatever year, 27 years.
20,
And
26.
the way that it works for the organization who ordained me is that there's no set dogma, there's no church, there's nothing to say, now you're a minister, you have to do this. It's up to each person to decide how they want their ministry to be in their communities. So some people, for instance, never do any ceremonies. Some people just want to work with people who are dying in a hospice. Other people who are trained counselors want to incorporate spiritual counseling into their counseling practice. So it's up to each person to see where their calling takes them. I always knew I wanted to do ceremony because when I left the Catholic Church, that was the thing that I most missed was the ceremony. And now I just do weddings. I have done a funeral, I do baby blessings, but on the whole, what I promote is the weddings because I love working with couples. And I love conducting the wedding ceremonies. So that is my predominant business in Ireland because I fought to get us legal status. In Ireland, it's not the person who is registered to do the ceremony, it's the organization. So I had to fight to get my organization recognized as legal solemnizers. And once that was the case, then the 20 of us who were in that organization automatically could be on the register of solemnizers. So I've been doing that legally since 2013 in Ireland. So that's what, how many years is that? 12 years I've been doing that So that's my predominant business in Ireland is as a celebrant. But then I love doing the consultancy. I did start to write a book about it, but then I'm kind of I couldn't be bothered putting the effort in to do that. I thought, no, I'll work with people who are interested in developing. It could do with just a bit of guidance and a bit of, So I don't guide people about like how to draw up a budget to get money from the bank, how to complete a grant application. I don't do any of that. It's far more really about them. Where are they going? How do they define themselves? What do they want from their business? And how are they going to get there? I mean, one of the things that strikes me working with people is that when people set up a business, a lot of people, especially after COVID, especially with being made redundant, they train as like a life coach or a therapist, an alternative therapist, etc. Fine, and now they're qualified to do it, but they have absolutely no idea about business, about how to get clients, what they should be saying to clients, how to charge, and all of that. So I find that when I say to people often, what's your business? They will answer by saying, oh, I do this and I do this and I do this and I can do this and I can do this, right? Which of course is completely wrong because that is not focused on the client at all. They should be saying, I help people to do X, Y, and Z in order that they did it. Because if you don't key in to what the client wants, you're going to be dismissed anyway. And I also learned that on the whole, people want a specialist. They don't want somebody who says, I can do a million things. They want somebody who says, this is my area of expertise. And then they think, right, yeah, they're going to know about that, Now, okay, other things might come in. But so I help people to look at how they define their business and how they define their roles. So that's coming back to the business side. That's a very quick summary of everything I do.
It's like helping people to focus in one niche, basically, right?
Well, if people are, say, doing life coaching or they're an acupuncturist, they're already in a niche. That's what they trained in. It's just that now, when it comes to, so how are you getting your clients and what do you, and who do you want to attract? Do you want to attract people who would go somewhere else and you want them to come to you? Do you want to attract people who've never thought of doing this before? Because if you don't know who you're targeting, you don't know what marketing strategies to use anyway.
I was kindly going in the wrong direction because I have a question. Like when you mentioned about your workshops on diversity and equality, I have a practical question because it's something that bothers me when it comes to equality and diversity. From my perspective, sometimes, for the sake of diversity and equality, the effectiveness or the I don't know or the skills of other people are kind of, or the expertise of other people are put in danger. So basically, what I'm trying to say here is that from my perspective, diversity and equality should not go over how a person is prepared or educated to do that kind of job. If you understand what I mean, because sometimes what I've noticed, and here is where my problem is. You will have I don't know, better skilled people than others in a certain areas or on certain jobs, but then because of the equality and diversity laws, you have to actually take someone else because you have to fill that position with someone else. So if that makes sense. So what do you think from your perspective? So from your perspective, will this diversity and equality law, because basically this is where the problem is when it comes to law, will affect businesses in certain ways.
Well, yes, and I understand your point. People think they're just going to have to do a tick box exercise and they won't necessarily get the best person for the job. Okay, so now in my experience, right now, people don't get the best person for the job because if they did, there would be a lot more women nearer the top. So that's the first thing, you know. What's happening is if you have two people who are exactly the same skills level, competence, you know, resume, you know, if they have two people who will then, yes, take the person who can bring something different to the team, but then they would both be the best person for the job. And now you're taking someone who can give something extra because of their diverse perspective. You don't take on anybody just because, oh, we need a black person in the team, so we'll take them. And now we can say, yeah, we've got a black person in the team. I mean, I know of women who end up not being able to be promoted because they've told me, no, my manager won't support my promotion because he says if I go, it'll affect his numbers of women he's got on his team. So he wants to keep me. So he won't help me to go on. Okay. So
Oh,
there's
I
a
know what you mean.
stuff that's going on subconsciously. And no, you should never just do a tick box exercise. But the problem is when people say to me, oh, we always about appoint the best person for the job, and I say I don't necessarily believe them because they don't know what it is that's stopping them from doing that. The unconscious bias that we all have, if you're not absolutely aware of what your bias is, I mean, when I've done these workshops with managers, I could have 100 managers. I used to do like an interactive presentation for 2 hours, and there could be 200 people there, and I would walk around the room, and they would all start by thinking, they don't need this, they don't want to be here. You know, they're very aware of their biases and they're very competent managers and they're not, etc. So what we do is I take them through an exercise, an experiential exercise, where they all do exactly that. And at the end of it, they say, oh my God, I do this all the time. I do this all the time. They didn't realize they did it because they were of the mindset, I'm fine, I know all about this, and I, you know, and then they do this exercise quite happily. I mean, at the end of it, you know, that they realize they've all just done exactly that. I mean, if we've time, I can explain what that exercise is. Really interesting. And that was the workshop that people most often wanted me to come and give. And it's not about you have to compromise your beliefs. It's not about you have to change your beliefs. It's just that if you're in an organization and you have very strong beliefs about something, and then you come up against somebody who doesn't share your beliefs, then the bell ought to go. Now you have to be extremely careful now, otherwise you impose your beliefs on them and judge them as not being okay, and you can't do that. So people who have very entrenched beliefs, whether it's about women, whether it's about black people, whatever it's about, people who have very entrenched beliefs have to work a lot harder so their beliefs don't spill out, because what'll happen is it'll affect someone else's performance, and you don't have the right to affect someone else's performance because of your beliefs. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, and it makes sense, like, and then on the other side of the coin, you'll never know how good is someone until you actually work with him.
But you know, one of the key principles in diversity training is if you are you in every interaction you have with any other person, whether it's the doorman coming in, or whether it's the tea person, or the manager, or the CEO, whoever it's with, in every interaction, there could be an issue of difference that will stop that interaction being as effective as it might be. So what we've all to do is to check every interaction we have with everybody to make sure that's not happening, that we are not doing that. So the personal responsibility is enormous, and a lot of people have never had to think about that. Why? Because they've been surrounded by people in the workplace who are like them. So there's never been an issue of real difference, you know? But suddenly now there's a diverse workplace. A lot of people are different, that people's values of time are different, how people deal with things, people personal space. Now, the organization, of course, needs to set up team guidelines and team standards, but it's very hard to treat somebody really well so they'll perform well if you really don't like them. That's where the work is. If you like them, it's a problem.
And the cultural differences too. Like, I mean, I know from my African friends, I have some Nigerian friends, and from their perspective, like when they have interaction with other person, if there is eye contact, that it means that it's disrespectful. So basically, you know, for the if you, an older person speaks with I don't know, with a younger person, the younger person has to look down, never in the eye. While in our case, if you don't have eye contact, it's disrespectful. It means
Absolutely. Yeah.
so.
So we just need to be aware. We just need to be aware of these things, that maybe it's not about being disrespected. Maybe there's a cultural norm going on here. It's the same with smiling. There are cultures who aren't grinning like idiots all the time. You know, we think that's how you establish contact, you by smiling. And then you meet somebody who doesn't smile and you think, oh, what's the matter with them? They're not very friendly. And you know, well, maybe in their culture it's not respectful to just keep grinning at everybody. You know, that's not what you do kind of thing. Now, yeah, there's an argument. People say, well, if they come to this culture, then you know they have to fit in with this culture. Yeah, there's an element of that. But there are, it makes it easier if everybody understands what's going on. Then that makes it much easier. But a lot of people are judged because of their difference, and they're judged as being less thans. We have a very strong more than less than mentality, and in organizations you can see it. It's very prevalent. So the more thans like being more thans, and they keep their more than status by having a lot of less thans around them, and that suits them. And as soon as somebody wants to be treated as somewhat, they don't like it, you know. So there are a whole lot of things going on, and all that is actually like a cultural difference. I mean, there are a lot of people who've been brought up, especially in the West, in a certain way, and that's how they behave. That's fine, except they think it's the only way to behave, you
No,
know.
I there is where the problem is. Like, well, you have more work experience than years I have. I was born in 1882, but I still have some things that stay stick with me from the communist times, you see. But I'm well aware of them because lately I've started to, you know, to look, to analyze myself and to see, you know, how can I interact better with people, and how can I go, you know, how can I think outside the box? Because if you don't change your mindset, you will not be able to thrive in any country, anywhere in the world. So you have to change all the mentality and everything. And the hardest thing is, you see, the truth, it's not absolute.
Absolutely. I mean, that is the truth. Yeah.
The truth, yeah, the truth
Truth
is.
isn't absolute. The problem is that the dominant culture expects everybody else to be the ones who change, to fit in.
Exactly.
You know, they don't think, well, is there something I could do here? Is there something I need to change? It's always them. Let me give you an example. I was doing a workshop, you know, in a bank, senior managers, and they were talking about a manager, an area manager, and they were saying he was very good, this area manager, because he, when he was appointed, he was inviting everybody to go for like drinks, like on a Friday at 6 o'clock. It wasn't this great. He was getting to know people, okay, and There was a woman in the group. There were very few women in those days in these senior management groups. And she said, "Well, I can't make it at 6 o'clock because I've got to get home to the children." So, and then a Muslim would say, "Well, I'm not going to meet up for drinks because, not a thing." So the group was saying to the woman, "Well, you just need to tell the manager that, tell the area manager that." And the woman said, "You know what?" She said, "I am sick of sticking up my hand and saying, 'Hey, don't forget me, I'm here.' Because then people will say to her, 'Well, you're the one who decided to have children. It's not, wasn't our decision for you to have children.'" And I was saying to the group, "This is the fault of the area manager. The area manager should have said, 'I want to get to know my team. I'm going to have drinks at 6. Now, is there anybody who's going to be excluded from this? And then what can I do as well as that in order that I include all my team?" That was his job to do that. Not people who get left out to keep saying, "I'm here, I'm here, I'm here," because people get sick of that, so they stop doing it, So that the responsibility really is on the managers and senior managers to set the right culture so that so these interactions are effective. Because that's what we're talking about at the end of the day. We're talking about business being more effective, performance being more effective. If somebody's not performing, you need to look at why they're not performing. It's not just that they're incompetent. We need to look at what else is going on that maybe is stopping them performing, like they're never included in meetings, or they don't get the latest info in the team because they're not in the in group, so nobody thinks to tell them what's going on. There's all the sacrifices that go on in an organization, really, that might not deliberately exclude people. I mean, the classic, decisions being made on the golf course, is not a joke. I mean, it's the kind of thing that it's the kind of thing that happens. So if you don't play golf, and in those days, women couldn't join the golf club anyway, then it's too bad. None of them would have said, we're gonna talk about this on the golf course because it'll cut out women." No, they just don't think about it. Just
No,
don't
you
think
are
about
right.
it.
Yeah, you are right. What, like, in your years of working and doing counseling and, helping companies and managers, what was the biggest challenge you encountered? Your biggest challenge?
Resistance to the idea that a change was needed. Really, if people are resistant, and that's why often we wanted to start with the top. Often I would do a session for the board, and then those board members would each introduce the workshop to their teams, their senior team, so they could say, "I've done this, and I want you to go through it." A lot of training, the bosses are saying to the staff, "You do it," or put the staff through this," and they're not doing it. That overcomes the resistance because you've got the managers at the top actually saying, "I have done this, and I want you all to go through this program as well." So I think resistance, challenging the status quo, is hard. Because, I mean, in those days, I was challenging the status quo about women. That's how I started. And of course, the truth of the matter is, if men have been used to having the power, if you bring more women into that role, there's going to be less men. They're not going to be expanding teams to make women an addition. So men realize, "Hang on, hang on. We're now not only competing against other men, competing against women as well." So of course they're going to be, if you've got power, you want to hold on to it, whether you realize it or not. That was what was happening. We can see it now in politics. People in power don't want to let it go, right? So bit by bit, when companies started to see, actually, the business is doing better. Since we had a woman in that senior sales role, women would never be appointed into senior sales roles because people thought, no, it was a man's role, not women. And then the women were in the role and they suddenly found that their sales were up. Why? Because when women would go out and meet the client, women would remember, "Oh, it was your wife's birthday last week. Did you have a nice day? Or your last time I saw you, your child was sick. I hope your child's better. The women were naturally forming relationships that at that time men weren't forming at all because it wasn't business, And then people realized, hang on, this is more effective having relationships like that. The relationships were more solid, and the women were competent at the job. There wasn't any doubt about their competency. The relationships were better. The sales went up, and then people thought, oh, okay, so women do well in this role. But I tell you, the few women who used to forge the way ahead, it was really, really hard going for them. I mean, women got so tired of doing it. And still there's that thing that to go to the next level, you have to be prepared to work 8 to 5 hours a week and be called in at a minute's notice. And women were saying, you know what? I've got a life. I'm not doing it. So then the companies would say to me, oh, well, we have all these roles open for promotion and women aren't applying. So what do you do? So I said, then you need to look at why. Go back and ask the women why they're not applying. Not just say, oh, well, women aren't applying, so we'll just appoint men. So it's narrow thinking that causes that, and reminding people all the time that at the end of the day, this is about making business better, not about just, doing something nice for women. It's about contributing to your business and making it more profitable. Then people began to see the results of that coming through. But for the few women who were forging the way, I'm telling you, it was hard.
Yeah, I think we live in 2024, we live in one of the best times the earth had, because for most of the things, some other people fought the fights, as you would say, so everything is prepared, like you have absolutely no excuses, if you know what I mean.
But it's not, I mean, it's not done. People say to me now, well, we've got equality now.
No,
We've got
it's not.
equality. No, they haven't got equality. You only have to look over the board at the gender pay gap. I mean, it's there. It's stark. And then women bring cases against the organization and the organization loses its reputation. I mean, it's still not, it's not right. It's still not right, But anyway, I mean, change takes a long time. It's like having an oil tanker and trying to turn it in the direction. You can't just turn the wheel once and then it's working at 90 degrees now. It takes a while to turn the machine,
From my perspective, I don't care if it's white, if it's black, if it's woman, if it's men, if it is Chinese, if it is African. I don't care what it is, how long it does the job properly and everything
I
goes well. I don't care,
No, but the thing is, a lot of people would say that about themselves. I really don't care. It's that whole thing, some of my best friends are black thing. It's that whole thing. Well, I don't pay any attention to that. It's just about competence. Well, yeah, but then just check your biases. Let me tell you briefly. Have we time for me to tell you about that little
Oh yeah,
exercise?
please, yeah.
Okay, so the exercise would be, we'd started off by looking at a really simple scale of how you can treat people as a one or a two or a three. Okay,
Okay.
one is you really like people. You give them all the information first. You meet them in the canteen. You go for it. So ones are great. Two, well, you're not. They're okay, and you'll be quite formal with them. You won't be overly friendly, but they're okay. Three, you really don't like them. Even if you don't cotton on, you don't like them, you'll treat them like you won't put them forward for the next big project. You have a meeting when they're off work on a day's holiday. So those are the one, two, and three. So what we do is I show them eight photographs, black and white photographs, up on the screen, and they look at these photographs for like 10 seconds, 15 seconds, and I ask them to rate the photographs one, two, or three. In that, if you look at a photograph and think, yeah, nice, that's a one. If you look at a photograph and think, yeah, you're okay, that's a two. If you look at a photograph and think, oh my goodness, that's a three. They all do it. Nobody says, how can we decide that in only 10 seconds? No, everybody does it. So then we do a debrief on the whole. Okay, so I pick one photograph, and it might have been the guy with who was unshaven, and he had piercings in his nose and his eyebrow, and he had one hand up, he had a leather glove on, and he's not smiling, and he's not looking at the camera. So how many people scored him? A three, and loads of
Most.
people. So I said, how many people scored him as a one? One or two? And the others who scored him a three are looking at the one and two. So I said to the ones, so why did you score him as a one? And they said, well, I think he looks like he's an artist, and I like artists, and he looks like he's a thoughtful guy. You know, he's not smiling, and I like that. So I go to the threes. So who scored him a three? Why? I tell you, the things that came out. Well, he's dirty, he's dishevelled, he probably tells lies, he's probably a criminal. There was one guy who gave this whole character description of him, ending with, he's probably a serial rapist. And I said to the guy, I said, wow. I said, and you got that after 10 seconds looking at a picture. That's impressive. So they're getting the message now, right? So then I go to a picture of a woman, very nice smiling woman, fresh face, white, short brown hair, smiling. Nearly everybody in the room scores her as a one. Okay, so then I say, right, so we do this about a few of the pictures. So already they're getting the idea that some people are seeing these people differently to how they were seeing them. And then I say, okay, I'm going to give you some information now about these people. And based on what I tell you, I want you to rescore them. You know, you might want to keep the score the same, you want to rescore them. So the guy who they thought was really like, dirty, I say, oh, well, he's an animal rights activist, and he's also an author, and he's a painter, and he's got two kids. He's a single dad, and he's trying to sell his paintings so he can provide for his kids. Nearly everybody scores him up the second time. Okay. When it comes to the girl who's really fresh faced and smiling, I say, now here's Sarah. She's a lesbian, and she plans to have a child with her female partner. Nearly everybody puts her down. Okay. So then I ask them why they've done that, and they explain why quite happily. There's one guy who's a Sikh. He's got a turban on, and he and his story. So he doesn't get marked. He's okay, but he doesn't get marked terribly. Nobody marks him as a one. Okay. His story is that he's going out with his white Christian girlfriend, but he's not told his parents about her because it's like against his religion. So that provokes a huge argument because some people think, oh, I feel really sorry for him, and they score him up. Other people say, no, he's telling lies. If he's lying to his parents, he's going to be lying about other things. If I knew that, I'm never going to trust him in the team. I'll never believe anything he said. I mean, really worked up, you know. So I'm saying, I remember saying this to a particular woman who was nearly red in the face telling me this. I said, so for you, telling lies is a big value. Being honest is a big value. Yeah, absolutely. I said, so basically, anybody in your department who only tells even a half truth, you're going to cut them out because of your belief, your value, whether it's their value or not. Okay. So I mean, we don't spend too long on this because I'm just saying, look, we all do this. Everybody does this. And I've given some examples from my own life of where I do it and have to watch myself kind of thing, you know. And of course, the lesbian woman, she gets marked down, even though she started as a one. And the point I make is, you see, I said all of that information, by the way, was made up. None of it's true. But I could carry on giving you more and more information about these people, and you would keep on moving your score until you get to a point where you hear something and then bad that you think is bad. And then it doesn't matter what you hear that's good, they're always going to be three. Or you hear something that's really on the other way around, that's so good it'll overlook whatever the other the bad stuff is. I said, and we have to know where those lines are for ourselves, because after that somebody's going to cross them, and we're going to think it's they who've crossed the line, not that it's our belief that's been stuck somewhere, and now we judge everybody who has got a different kind of belief. I said, and this is happening all the time, because people are kind of saying, oh my God, I do this all the time. I said, no, I pick obvious things like being a lesbian, being a Muslim, or being a Sikh, being an artist, piercings, you know. There are a million reasons. I said, I used to have a thing about men whose handshake was weak. I shook hands with a man and the handshake was weak. I used to think he's a weak guy. I couldn't, you know, and I said, when these first thoughts come in, you don't ask for them to come in. I said, on the hands, that thought, oh, weak guy, is laid right on top. I said, so here's the rule, you know, notice the first thought and work on the second. So my first thought is, weak guy. My second thought is, stop that. This is an okay guy and you're going to work with him. So just stop doing that. You know, okay, now let's work together. You know, that's nothing to do with him. It's to do with how I'm managing my likes and dislikes, you know. And when people have never really had to do that, they all say they've done it about the very obvious ones like race and disability and women, although a lot of them still haven't. But when it comes to small things like, you know, the size of somebody's knot in the tie, which school they went to, what's their accent? Well, you know, we're doing it all the time. I said, no, it's not a problem deciding you don't like somebody. So that means that you wouldn't have a drink with them after work. We're in the workplace here. You don't have the luxury of saying, well, I don't like the look of him, so I'm not going to bother working with him. No, your company's employed you to get the best out of all of these people. You can't do it. I had a very funny story when I was in Dubai, actually, and there was a group of about 120 there. And the client had said to me, because she'd traveled round all of these different countries with me, she said, okay, we're in a Muslim country, you need to take out the lesbian woman because it's just going to provoke. I said, okay, I said, I'm telling you, it'll come up in the workshop, but okay. So I took it out the workshop, I took it out the exercise. Of course, it came up in the workshop because I was talking about not imposing your beliefs on others. So this guy, who was a senior manager, he said, so hang on. Hang on, he said. Now I'm Muslim, he said, and I think homosexuals are evil and they're going to go to hell. He said, it's as simple as that. He said, so you're telling me I have to change my beliefs? I said, no, I'm not. Not telling you. He said, well, you're telling me I have to compromise them. I said, no, I'm not. You can have whatever beliefs you want, but this company is committed to not discriminating on the grounds of sexuality. And you signed up to work in this company and you knew what the deal was. So it's just going to be a lot harder for you to be following the company guidelines. I said, and if you decide it's pushing your integrity too much and you can't, no, that's a step too far. I said, then you've no option but to resign from the company. Well, the client, and I'm walking around the room saying this, and the client's at the front of the room. So the client comes down and says, I think what Geraldine means is, I said, no, Geraldine means if it's that so important to you will have to resign. Anyway, I moved on. We didn't linger on it. And then later on, as I'm walking around and I glanced at this guy and he was writing something and somebody called out, he's just writing his resignation. It was so funny. But you know, these are important messages, and they can be done in a kind of fairly light-hearted way. I didn't judge anybody. I didn't say to anybody, you shouldn't think that about that picture. It's not for me to say. It's for me to say, now, when you're in an organization, you're going to have a problem if you think like that. That's my job. How are you going to handle that working in this organization?
That's why I believe that it is very, very important to be honest on the interview stage, because I have friends and I know so many people who lied in the interview stage, and after the interview stage, when they were accepted, they were trying to fight for their views or their religious views or they, which is wrong. You should be honest at the beginning. If that is a very high value for you, your employer has to know about that.
Yeah, but before you go for an interview, you've already Check them out on the website. You've got the job specification, you've got the person spec, you know what's expected. So if you still go for the interview, you're not going to say something that contradicts all of that, or else you just won't get the job. I have to say, well, why are they even going for that job? Because they know that company is going to be challenging them all the time. So yeah, that they shouldn't be even going for that job. But then these days, people need a job and they have to pay the mortgage. So I mean, as long as everybody knows, you can't impose a belief, a personal belief on someone else so that it affects their performance. We're always getting back to performance here and competence, not personal likes and dislikes.
While I was a student, I had a colleague, a girl, now very smart, very, very smart girl. So I'll tell you what she did. It's a funny story, but it's a real story. So I'll tell you what she did. So we were first years in computer science, but she was looking for a senior position. Now we barely knew coding. We were just starting, so we knew nothing, but we were kind of adult students. Like I was, what, 26, 27. So she was pretty much around the same age. So she said, "You know what? I'm looking for a senior position." So what she's done, she on her CV, she lied. Period. So she lied on her CV. But was the mentality behind her lie was very interesting. Like I've done psychology before, and then when you were mentioning about the pictures exercise, actually there is a personality test called in psychology, where and I'll go back to the girl story afterwards. So where it will show you 24 pictures, but in rounds of four. So it will show you four pictures, and you'll have to pick up the person that you dislike the most
Well, interesting.
from all of those four. So when I've done that personality test on me, so basically the test is based on your first instinct, first impression, what you see first. So funny enough, exactly my full personality came up at the end. What I like, what I don't like, the way I am, everything. It was like when she started to read the results of my test, I was like an open book. I couldn't believe it. That was like, what, 20 years ago. But going back to the young lady. So what she did, she lied in her CV. But the idea behind lying on her CV and making her CV outstanding was, she said, "If I manage to stay 3 months in a company, because they will figure out you don't know anything, you can't stay more than 3 months. You maybe 6, but in 3 months they will figure out you don't know what you're doing, But she said, "If I manage to stay 3 months, in those 3 months, I'm going to pick as much as I can from the other senior managers. Then I'm going to move on in the next company." And she did it for six companies. So she moved on 3 months. In some companies, she lasted 1 month because they could figure out straight away that she's lying. But after the sixth company, now she works in the same place for the last 12 years in a senior position. Like I'm telling you, but she was very, very, very smart. Very smart. So this is what she did. Now, that's why I said, because even if you look at the color of the skin, of the culture, of whatever it is, you won't be able to know their effectiveness or how good they are in that job until you really work with them, until you give them tasks to complete, because sometimes they will be very smart, they will do it, or they will find somebody else in the company to do them for them, because I've seen that a lot lately. Now, you've already mentioned the funny story. What advice now you what advice would you give to, I don't know, to companies, medium companies in Ireland, I don't know, that they are looking to grow, to bring their business to the next level. What piece of advice would you have for them?
Well, I'm not, I mean, medium companies are still quite big, right?
Well,
So there are going to be so many other things that come into play that would not be my area of expertise, like, I don't know, product segmentation and, does the market want more of what we have? So therefore, how are we going to get a share of that market? But there'll be all of those. I mean, that's the big question. What is your business and how can you grow? And for the person owning the business, of course, then if it's a medium-sized company, there's going to be a board. So there's a CEO who's a figurehead, but then there's going to be a managing director who kind of is the operational manager, probably, but it's not quite the same as like one person trying to, having five staff or even starting off on their own. Those are the people that I'm probably best working with. But I would say know how you can, the market's changing so fast. Know how you can change with the market. I heard many years ago a brilliant story that I've never forgotten. From a guy at a conference, and he told this story as part of his presentation. And he said there was a guy who used to make terry toweling nappies for babies. In the days before disposable nappies, everybody had terry toweling nappies. And when asked what he did for a living, he said, "Oh, I make terry nappies. I make cotton nappies for babies." Of course, then disposable nappies came in, and pretty soon he's out of business. Okay. And the guy said he answered the question incorrectly. When he was asked what to do for a living, he should have said, "I'm in the business of covering babies' bottoms," because then he would have moved with the market, And as it was, he was stuck doing his one product, and then the market didn't want it anymore, and he's gone. I mean, he didn't have anything, So I always, and that's why you have people paid a lot of money at high level, looking at the strategy. What's the next thing? What's the next thing? Where are we going? Do we just want to be big in Ireland? Do we want to be big in Europe? Are we going for global sales? Are we going for Far East sales? What? How are we going to manage that? How are we going to do dealing with another culture? Let's look at what our product, would it go down in that? I mean, you're paying people a lot of money to do all of this, and I'm sure they're all doing it. So I wouldn't necessarily be advising them on that. That's not, I don't think, where my business mentor skills would be. It would be on much smaller outfits where people are just kind of starting off. And I mean, one of the women that I had, she had a successful business that I was mentoring. And she had a successful business. She was turning over, I don't know, just over 100,000 a year. I mean, not massive. And she was looking at a how to she had a hand in everything, like you do when I started. You do everything, and you have to learn to start letting go of some things, even if they don't do it as well as you, they'll do it well enough, kind of thing. So she was learning that, and she was looking at how to extricate herself altogether from the business. She was looking at how she could just keep one or two. So she was a bit of a crossroads herself. So I was able to help her define her own goals, and then how she could do it, how she could get there, kind of thing, because she had built up the business from nothing. So, but she's very good. But it was kind of then, okay, so where to from here? And ultimately, she was looking to get out of her business altogether. She wanted an exit strategy. And often I say to people, when you set up a business, look at what your exit strategy might be, because otherwise you're going to be trapped in it before you know it, especially if you get very successful very quickly. Now you're trapped in your own business, and you know that if you go or if you do anything else, you've no business left. So how are you going to manage that, and I would say it's things like when I started, it was very much nobody knew who I was, nobody knew who my company was. So my strategy was visibility. I mean, I would go and speak everywhere I could for no fee. I'd go, all these companies have got, they're always looking for somebody to come in and talk. for their HR meetings, somebody to
Hmm.
come in and give a lunchtime presentation. So I would offer, I'll do that. I can do that. I'll do that for you. I can come and do that for you. So I did all of that. And bit by bit, of course, and we had a newsletter which we used to send out. At that time, I had no idea. I started to build up a client list. I had no idea who even read the newsletter. But pretty soon, I had people saying to me, "Oh my God, I see the Domino newsletter everywhere I go." These are the days when there was a phone box. This is how old I am. A red phone box. And somebody said, "Last week, I saw your Domino newsletter in a phone box. Are there, it's every..." So, okay, well, that's okay. So that's working then. I got used to looking at how to appear to be very successful. Like, we set up what we call then an equal opportunity subscription service. So clients paid, it was like nothing, it was like £200 a year, but I am going back 40 years. So they paid £200 a year, and every quarter we sent them, we provided them with a very nice binder. We provided them with a case study, the latest on the law, a little quiz, whatever, whatever, right? So they could build up their folders, and we offered this service where I said, if you have an immediate problem with your equal opportunities, you can phone this line, phone this number, and I will guarantee you that within 24 hours, you will have 30 minutes free consultancy to solve your problem. And people said to me, "You're crazy. You're crazy doing that, because you're going to be in it, you'll never be off the phone." I said, "Just watch." In that first 12 months, there were two calls, and I took them both. I didn't have to use anybody else. But everybody who saw that was on offer thought this was an incredible service. They never used it, but they still thought it was an incredible service. So you have to start keying into what are people going to find attractive, and what are they going to like? And there was a scheme in the 80s where there was a big, it was called Women Returners. Everybody was trying to attract women who'd had children back to work and make the workplace more friendly. This was the beginning of it, right? So everybody's setting up these women. In fact, the biggest contract we ever got was from a bank that paid a lot of money for us to do a women returners package for them, okay? So I was contacted by a national recruitment agency. And they said, "Oh, we're running these conferences all over the UK. And the nearest one to you, we've heard about you. Nobody knew me, but we've heard about you. The nearest is Nottingham. Would you speak at the Nottingham launch?" So I said, "Well, yeah." I said, "But where's your big launch event?" They said, "Oh, that's at the Queen Elizabeth Hall in London." I said, "I'd rather speak at that one." And they said, "No, we have all our speakers for that." I said, tell me who the speakers are." So they told me one of them was a cabinet minister. So I think to myself, there's no way he's going to make that. So this is in Margaret Thatcher's government. I thought, there's no way. So I said to this recruitment agency, "Okay, I'm tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to keep that date free for you. And if anybody pulls out at the very last minute, then I'm here." Sure enough, of course, the week before, or the 3 days, he had to pull out because Margaret Thatcher wanted this emergency cabinet meeting, and he was gone. So they called me. Now, it was a huge risk because nobody had seen me speak. Nobody really knew anything, and I was the keynote speaker. So what I realized then was that it was a huge audience. All the women are smiling and nodding and saying, "Thank God someone is saying that," and all the men are looking really uncomfortable. I thought, okay, so this isn't good, because it's the men who've got the power. So if the men are not taking to me, I'm never going to get in. So I thought, right, I've got to change how I appear to these men. Okay, so I started getting some designer clothes. I mean, I had purple hair at the time. I refused to change that. So I had my hair done. I had makeup on. I had designer clothes. I smiled a lot. I looked like any one of their wives. I could have been going into their house for a tea party with the wife. So when I would go in to speak to these people, they were quite open because I looked so familiar to them, if you like. And then by the time they heard what I was actually saying, they had to react to my words. Whereas if I'd gone in with, the traditional, this is what a feminist looks like, sandals, short hair, no makeup. Then they'd have switched off before I'd got halfway across the stage, So it's okay. I need to key into the men who have the power, so I can get in front of them, then talk to them about what's important, So I used to really enjoy that part, working out how do I manage to break down some of these barriers so I can actually get in front of them and they'll listen to what I have to say. So it was great. I found it great fun. It was good, and it worked very well. But of course, I got a lot of work after that,
Before we are going to close, I'm just going to. I usually ask all the people I interview to share a very funny or embarrassing story while they were, I don't know, presenting something or while they were in business. Something that, it was funny enough or funny or I don't know. Something that happened on the stage, or something that you can relate to.
Oh my word. Well, there were so many funny things that happened. I'm just trying to think of anything that was really, really embarrassing.
Well, I don't want to put you in a very bad spot now, because
No,
sometimes.
I mean, maybe I was arrogant enough to be oblivious to what might have been embarrassing. I don't know. I mean, I can think of lots of very personally embarrassments in my life, but just thinking in terms of business, whether the only time I could have got, well, not caught out, I worked with a building society based on the South Coast, and the CEO was on his way somewhere, and I was in the Midlands, and he asked, could he pop in and see me? And then he said, do you think you'll have a spare office? And I said, yeah, absolutely. So I'm thinking, oh my God, you think I'm in a converted garage in the back of my house, and he thinks I'm in a big office here, So that was, I mean, and I just had to, brave my way through that. He came in, and there was his garage, and it was divided into three sections. So I had my office, and then like a little meeting room, and then the main office where all the photocopying and all of that went on, But I mean, he had to walk like into the backyard, and I thought, oh my God, this is going to be awful now, But I just brazened my way through that, and he was fine.
Actually, it's a funny one. Geraldine, thank you very, very much for your time. Tell me, would you have anything coming up in Ireland very, very soon?
Well, to be honest, I don't do any marketing for my consultancy now. In fact, I never did, to be honest. Everything came to me through word of mouth. So if I get invited to speak somewhere, I tend to, I don't do it for free anymore, of course. But I mean, if I get invited to speak, then I do. Most of my marketing is done about weddings and attracting couples to come and get married in the West, and then I can marry them. But I don't run anything open anymore, because I mean, now I've scaled right down, so there is just me in Domino Perspectives. There's just me. I have no secretary, I have no admin, I have no anything. I do my own accounts on QuickBooks, and I mean, because it's a very, very, very small business now, which is the way I wanted it when I came to Ireland, of course, So no, I've nothing coming up, but if anybody is listening and they like anything they've heard, and they'd like me to go and talk to their team or their staff or their managers, then of course contact me. And if anybody who's listening is running a small business and think they could do with any help, a business mentor to get them over a hump, then obviously contact me. I'd be delighted.
Or if anyone listening wants to get married,
Come to the West and I'll marry you. Absolutely.
come to the West and we'll have a nice party.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you very much. I wish you all the best.
Yeah, thanks, Bogdan, for inviting me. I appreciate it. Yeah.
It was a very warm interview.
Okay.
Okay, thank you guys. Thank you very much for listening. I am going to let you go. I hope you enjoyed our interview and look for the next one.